The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. Our first article comes to us on November 24, written by Yonat Shimron, and entitled, A Film Sheds Light on 11 Daring Women Whose Defiant Act Changed the Episcopal Church. 10 minutes into a new documentary on the battle for women's ordination in the Episcopal Church, a short archival clip shows the first time women were seated in full voting members in the denomination's House of Deputies. But even as women took that minor step forward, they were introduced by a male priest who described the women deputies as bringing us something the House has needed desperately for a long time, some beauty. Such were the belittling attitudes toward women 4 years before a group of 11 seminary-educated female deacons challenged their church to accept them as priests in 1974. The Philadelphia 11, a new documentary dozens of churches are now screening across the country, depicts the buildup toward the so-called irregular ordination, at which three bishops, with a fourth observing, ordained 11 women as priests without the denomination's approval. The ordination, often described as an act of disobedience, caused deep divisions in the church. The women were vilified in the media and in personal attacks, but they also paved a way toward the full embrace of women priests by the denomination 2 years later, in 1976. Next year marks the 50th anniversary of that irregular ordination, and the documentary casts a fresh light on that momentous time and on the methods used to achieve it. Six of the 11 ordained women, all white, are still living, and their eloquent testimonies that they are equal to men form the essence of the documentary. In contrast, male priests and bishops appear in the archival images railing against the idea of women priests, intoning that priesthood implies fatherhood, and as one priest insists, we cannot have a female rooster. Old-fashioned as those comments may sound, their sentiment is still widespread in Roman Catholic and Orthodox churches, where women have yet to be ordained, as well as in the Southern Baptist Convention, where women may not serve as pastors. The documentary also comes at a time when gender equality has stalled as state legislators restrict abortion and legislate against trans youth. We're in a space where women's rights are starting to get rolled back, and to understand the stories of the women who come before us and the shoulders we stand on is the only way we move forward, said Margot Guernsey, the film's director and producer. An independent Massachusetts-based filmmaker, Guernsey said she never heard about the Philadelphia 11 until she had a phone conversation with one of its leaders, the Reverend Carter Hayward, and came away wanting to know more. Guernsey set about filling in that gap in her knowledge. It turned into an 8-year odyssey that included interviews with the surviving Philadelphia 11 and the people around them, deep dives into reams of archival footage, and, most difficult of all, raising money for the documentary, underwritten by 1,200 individuals. Several of the Philadelphia 11 are now attending the church screenings. A wider distribution of the documentary is scheduled in late 2024. Hayward is figured prominently in the documentary. She and Emily Hewitt were among the group's leaders. In the early 1970s, both were studying at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. They were joined by Suzanne Hyatt, who was working as a social justice organizer at Church of the Advocate in Philadelphia. The Episcopal Church had no rule forbidding female priests, but ordaining them just wasn't done. After several attempts to allow women's ordination failed at General Conference, the three began to plot to shake up the status quo. It was not until the convention in Louisville in 1973 rejected women's ordination by an even greater margin than the 1970 convention in Houston that we realized something needed to be done to sort of crack open this thing, Hayward said, now 79. Times were changing. The Equal Rights Amendment was overwhelmingly approved by both houses of Congress in 1972. The civil rights movement for African Americans had a profound influence on the women. The documentary includes a powerful interview with Barbara Harris, the first woman and the first black woman to be consecrated a bishop in the Episcopal Church. In addition, other denominations have already begun ordaining women, including the United Methodist Church and parts of the Presbyterian Church, USA. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America first ordained a woman in 1970. Hyatt eventually convinced the Reverend Paul Washington, a black priest, to conduct an ordination for women at Church of the Advocate and recruited four bishops who were willing to take part. Word of the July 1974 ordination leaked to the press, and all the TV networks lined up to cover it. The church, which seats 1,000, was packed. After the three-hour ceremony, Episcopal bishops were called to an emergency meeting at O'Hare Airport in Chicago, where the ordination was ruled invalid, and the women forbidden from performing the sacraments. They did so anyway, celebrating the Eucharist at the Riverside Church in New York City, which is not affiliated with the Episcopal Church. Later, they were invited to celebrate the Eucharist at two Episcopal churches. Both male priests were put on church trial and charged with violating the church's constitution and canons for allowing it. But even after the General Convention in 1976 voted to allow women's ordination and regularized the ordinations of the Philadelphia 11, it was hard for women to find jobs leading churches. The Philadelphia 11 went on to teach in seminary, with some, such as Hayward, becoming theologians. Others served as chaplains. The Reverend Nancy Wittig spent the first 10 years after her ordination as a supply priest, filling in for vacationing clergy. She was eventually called to serve two small churches, one in New Jersey and one in Pennsylvania. Later, in Ohio, where she now lives, she worked as an assistant to a rector in a suburb of Cleveland. In a phone interview, Wittig noted with pride that her Ohio diocese just elected a woman bishop, and the Diocese of Southern Ohio has also called a woman to be its bishop. "It's happening," she said. "It's right and it's good." Halfway through the documentary, it becomes clear that five of the Philadelphia 11 were also gay. Hayward said only she and her friend Emily Hewitt were out at the time of the ordination. Others, such as Wittig, came out much later. In some ways, their sexual identities were linked to the defiance of prevailing norms. When you have been defined outside the box of what is considered the norm, that is, the male priesthood, you're already an outsider, Hayward said, suggesting it became easier to also embrace their sexual identity. Hayward has also gone further in her theological understanding. After retiring from the Episcopal Divinity School where she taught, she returned to the mountains of North Carolina, where she grew up, and bought some land for a therapeutic horseback riding center called Free Rein. She still considers herself an Episcopalian, but said she now has a hard time connecting to the Book of Common Prayer's gendered language. She now attends a Unitarian Universalist church. "I sometimes go to the Episcopal Church, but usually when they're having special services that are inclusive," Hayward said. "By that I mean services in which God is celebrated as both male and female, as mother, father, spirit lover. I worship in places where that is lifted up." Now an article published on November 24, written by Beth Kisseliff, entitled "From Past to Present, Jews speak out in one voice. On November 14, almost 300,000 American Jews, including my three children, and their allies, came to speak out in support of Jewish lives in Washington, one of the largest rallies of its kind. In New York that same evening, I attended the premiere of a show devoted to songs of the Holocaust at the Museum of Jewish Heritage in Battery Park. As the cast of 10 raised their voices, the juxtaposition of the two events provoked in me a question. Almost 80 years after the end of World War II, with Jewish lives again under threat in Israel, and anti-Semitism rising around the world, what does it mean to have the ability to speak out at this moment? In Washington, the rally felt like a salve for the pain of hate that many Jews had been feeling, particularly on college campuses like the one where my youngest daughter has just matriculated. We were together with so many who care deeply that our perspectives are heard. It gave a huge lift to those who were there, from Los Angeles, Houston, Minneapolis, Detroit, and closer by, undeterred by long distances and hours of travel. 80 years ago, 2 days before Yom Kippur in 1943, a group of 400 Haredi rabbis marched to the White House, one of the few times Jews spoke out against what was happening to Jews in Europe. One Jewish member of Congress wanted the march called off because it was undignified. A prominent Reform rabbi concurred. President Franklin Roosevelt slipped out of the White House rather than meet with the delegation. His snub made the news, however, and led to the formation of the War Refugee Board. In light of this history, it makes sense that in the current moment, Jews of all minds, those who are inclined to call for a ceasefire, and those who want to see Hamas forcibly removed, would gather simply to stand up for Israel and for Jewish determination to endure together. I had long before made plans to see the premiere of Amid Falling Walls, a multimedia musical journey presented by the National Yiddish Theater Volksbühne at the Museum of Jewish Heritage. The 27 songs sung in Yiddish were written between 1939 and 1945 in the ghettos of Warsaw, Vilna, Lodz, Krakow, and Bochnia, and in concentration camps, partisan encampments, and forest. Many of them were originally collected in 1948 by the Polish musician and poet Szmork Kaczergiński as Lieder von den Ghettos an Langem. They lend an understanding of how the Jews who experienced the Holocaust processed the catastrophe. But in the current moment, their themes also quietly captured the cycles of Jewish history and, again, how the Jews have endured. As the show's writer, Avram Modek, wrote in his program notes, the show is a joyous reminder that we have outlived and will continue to outlive those who seek our undoing. The Hamas attack on southern Israel, which came 2 days before rehearsals began on October 9, made the songs more meaningful than they have been, Abby Goldfarb, one of the performers, told me after the premiere. Another singer, Eli Meyer, who has family in Israel, and said the show helped him cope with the situation. And his castmate, Jacob Ben Shmiel, said that as rehearsals got underway, he had felt privileged to be unaware of the reality that the show depicts, but that the performers don't have that privilege after October 7. The show's creator and musical arranger, Zalman Modek, said in a phone interview a few days after it opened, "I've been performing this music all my life, but never created a theatrical set for it." He had learned of many of the songs from his mother, Chana, who with her sister, Malki Gottlieb, had collected some of the songs in the show in a 1983 book, We Are Here, Songs of the Holocaust. He had heard the actuality behind them from his father, Yosel, who survived World War II in Vilna, Poland, then was fortunate to be granted passage out of Europe by the Japanese diplomat Shiuni Sugiyama, who secured freedom for many Jews during the war. He also went to Kobe in Japan and then Shanghai. The show, Moldek said, is part of his lifelong effort to transmit the heritage of Yiddish song, so important to both his parents. Because of the sensitivity of the material, he said, he didn't want to fabricate a story to pull the songs together, a Holocaust jukebox musical. They are accompanied instead with a montage of pictures and video of Jewish life in Europe. I wanted the songs to be living testimony, actual documents that illuminate, in a historical and factual way, deeply emotional and creative, how Jews lived and survived, Moldek said. The timing of the Hamas attack justified his decision. At this point in Jewish history, we are singing songs about the right for Jews to live as Jews, to fight back, and to do whatever is necessary to be able to live. The songs, he said, enable the audience to learn how people reacted and what they did, how they came together and how they functioned under the worst possible conditions, worst possible terror. The songs exist for people to take it in, to get stronger, to be comforted, to be inspired by it. The songs performed dysfunction in several ways, but their defiance is evident, as in the Warsaw ghetto cabaret tune, Shon Genug, Already Enough, and the best-known song, the partisan hymn, Zagnet Kemal, Never Again, composed by Hirsch Glick, on hearing about the 1943 Warsaw ghetto uprising, brutally crushed by German troops, after the ghetto's inhabitants resisted deportation. The notes on the songs in the program were made by Brett Werb, who is a staff musicologist at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. The songs themselves are all online at the Workers' Circle Archive. But with all the resonance of the current moment, I wished, watching the montages go by, that the show had told more about how those particular songs fit into the larger backdrop of the world in which they were composed. Yiddish song allows us to focus on how Jews lived and created, Avram Moldek, who was Zalman's son, wrote in the Wall Street Journal. I wanted to know more about how they did so and what it meant to their time. Hearing their voices mingled with those on the streets of Washington gave me hope. The cycles of Jewish history, despair, and uplift continue. When we learn how Jews in the past express themselves, we know that present day and future Jews will also be able to endure. Now a piece published on November 22, written by Jana Rice, entitled, A Fire at a Historic Chevy Chase Ward Raises the Question, What is Mormon Community Now? On November 20, a meeting house of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints went up in flames in Chevy Chase, Maryland. I learned about this when two people in my Facebook feed, who had fond memories of that chapel, posted their sadness and anxiety. According to local CBS news outlet WUSA 9, the fire resulted in a partial collapse of the building and required more than 100 firefighters to stop the flames. Thank heavens, no one was killed or injured. But there's been more than $10 million in damage, and it's not yet clear whether the building can be restored or will need to be replaced entirely. The cause of the fire had not been released as of this writing, but none of the news reports mention foul play. I don't have any personal history with that chapel, but it dates from the 1950s, the same decade as my own ward's meeting house. So I've been thinking of how devastated I would feel if something similar happened there. There's so much history in these buildings, affecting so many lives. I know that in terms of history, a church that is 70-something years old has nothing on a church that is, say, 700. But in Mormonism, so much of daily life has happened in these buildings, especially back then. The Chevy Chase building and my own ward building have hosted remarkable efforts at forging community. The 1950s marked a unique historical moment in the growth of the church, particularly in the Washington, D.C. area. Those were heady days. Ezra Taft Benson was taking his spot as President Dwight D. Eisenhower's Secretary of Agriculture, the highest post ever held by a Mormon in national life. Just about anything seemed possible for our young religion on the move. In terms of the media and its public image, the church was enjoying a kind of golden era. Between the anti-polygamy coverage of the late 19th and very early 20th centuries, and the critical treatments of the church's handling of race and gender. Criticism that began in the 1960s and really has not stopped. Both the Chevy Chase building and my own ward's building were constructed very differently from how the church does things today. Before the correlation program took hold in the late 1970s and 80s, members had to raise their own money to construct their local buildings. This resulted in a lot of architectural variety that many of us mourn the loss of now. When the church took over, the good news was that local wards didn't have to engage in massive fundraising efforts, on top of everything else, to erect their chapels, a welcome change that made having a chapel building just as possible for a poor community as for an affluent one like Chevy Chase. The bad news was that it instituted a somewhat soulless process of cookie-cutter meeting house plans that could be plopped down anywhere in the world and erected quickly. Efficiency, not beauty, was the rule. Pre-correlation mid-century LDS buildings sometimes came with extras that reflected the tenor of the times, facilitating the many extracurricular activities that were part and parcel of Mormon life. This vanquished social world is something that many older members of the church express great nostalgia for, and it comes through in a brief newspaper search of the early years of the Chevy Chase ward. In 1962, for example, the building made the news for hosting the theatrical Goodbye My Fancy, put on by the youth of the Washington State Mutual Improvement Association, later called Young Men and Young Women. This was no amateur roadshow, but an ambitious stage production based on a 1948 Broadway play and 1951 Joan Crawford movie, all done with volunteer talent. The following year, the Chevy Chase ward again made the news, this time for its success in the church's flourishing basketball league for high school boys, which at that time included teams from 4,000 wards across the United States. Chevy Chase won its region, beating teams across the eastern seaboard from Maine to North Carolina. Then it sent its undefeated team to the national championships in Salt Lake City. Writing of the team's chances, the local Montgomery County Sentinel boasted that the church's athletic program was probably the world's largest basketball league. I doubt that, but it's undeniable that the league's scope was massive and that it cemented many people's ties to the church during the week as well as on Sundays. It also affected the cookie-cutter architecture of local meeting houses henceforth. Even though we don't have basketball tournaments now, the larger plans still very much feature basketball courts. One more news clipping about the Chevy Chase ward, this time from the following year, 1964. The Baltimore Sun reported on the Singing Mormon Mothers, who headed to New York City to participate in a major musical extravaganza. They gave a preview concert at the Chevy Chase Meeting House before joining hundreds of other singing mothers who would perform opposite the Mormon Pavilion at the 1964 World's Fair. Other groups of singing Mormon mothers were organized in America and Europe from the 1920s through the 1970s, it seems, and were sometimes called the Relief Society Singing Mothers. All three of these activities have disappeared from ward life. We don't put on Broadway plays or even road shows anymore, participate in a national basketball league involving thousands of church teams, or spend hundreds of local or send local, excuse me, or send hundreds of local singers to perform at a world's fair. Nor have we replaced that vibrant social world with anything new, at least for adults. Granted, people are busy. More women work and kids have greater academic demands today, homework for kindergartners. Community building is time-consuming. In its slow erosion, though, the church has lost some of its vitality. Today, LDS adults have Sunday church, monthly temple nights, and self-directed gospel instruction at home, punctuated by the occasional and very welcome potluck or holiday celebration. If the Chevy Chase building has to be replaced, I hope it's done with respect, not just for the ward's religious life and sacrament meetings, but also for its secret sauce of community. I hope they keep not just a basketball court, but also a stage. Is it practical? No. Optimistic? Yes. Latter-day Saints used to be the geniuses at creating community in all kinds of creative ways. And judging from the atomization of society and growing loneliness of people around the world, that's going to be needed now more than ever. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.